Welcome to Cold Steel, the Canadian Journal of Surgery podcast, with your hosts Amir Farouk and Chad Ball. The goal of the CJS podcast is threefold. The first is to highlight the best research currently being completed by Canadian surgeons. The second is to offer educational topics for both surgeons and trainees alike. And most importantly, the third goal is to inspire discussion, thoughts, creativity, and career development in all Canadian surgeons. We hope you enjoy it.
Dr. Amin Madani is the director of the Surgical AI Research Academy at the University Health Network in Toronto. He's an endocrine and acute care surgeon at UHN and assistant professor of surgery at the University of Toronto. Dr. Madani talked to us and showed us some of the work he is doing on AI and surgery, and in particular on computer vision. He really breaks down for us the terms AI, machine learning, and surgical data science, and highlighted some of the promise and challenges for AI and surgery. Dr. Madani, thank you so much for joining us today on the Cold Steel podcast. It's truly an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show. Could you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and where you did your training?
Thanks for having me. Really exciting. Heard a lot about this podcast. Great to be here. So I kind of went all over the place. So I started in Toronto. That's where I did my undergrad, then went to Western for med school, then McGill for residency, where that's where I did also my research training and my PhD in surgical education. And then I went to New York for surgical endocrinology fellowship, and then finally back to Toronto. So that's sort of full circle, and started as staff here for the past few years.
That's a pretty awesome voyage. Tell us about your endocrine practice now, and what your days and weeks look like, and what drew you to that field in particular.
Yeah, sure. So endocrine surgery, I think a lot of people ask me, like, which organs do you guys deal with? So thyroid, parathyroid, and adrenals. I don't do too many neuroendocrine or pancreatic endocrine disorders. That's more for the HPB folks. But basically, we deal with everything from, the full comprehensive care of endocrine disorder, anything from the benign to the more complex endocrine oncology. My bread and butter is things like thyroid nodules, goiters. Thyroid cancer is a big part of my practice, parathyroid disorders, everything from primary to renal hyperpara, including secondary and tertiary. Adrenals, we do quite a bit. We're probably one of the more higher volume centers where we do everything from incidentalomas to, hormonally active tumors, to the more complex adrenocortical cancers, to the big en bloc resections. We try to do more innovative things, like here we do a lot of retroperitoneoscopic adrenals, for instance. We do a lot of minimally focused parathyroidectomies, and also we started radiofrequency ablation of thyroid nodules. So that's kind of like our practice for endocrine surgery. We do a lot of ACS as well. I would say I'm probably like 85% endocrine, 15% ACS. And I would say my practice is more like a 50-50 surgical and surgeon investigator type thing. So probably like 1 or 2 hours a week, 1 or 2 clinics a week, and 2 academic days. Living the dream.
I'm not very good at math, but somehow that doesn't seem to add up to 5 days a week or seven.
We make it fit. We squeeze that extra day into the week.
Not surprised. Not surprised about, I think, what some people would call AI in surgery. I think there's some terms that you like maybe better than that. And I think rightly so, because I feel like this term of AI or artificial intelligence surgery gets thrown around so much, and it must be galling. You know, like when I was in Boston doing my master's, I think there was like two terms that got thrown around all the time, which was blockchain and AI. And it used to drive me insane. So can you talk to us a little bit about like when people say AI, what really are we talking about? And in particular, how is that different than machine learning?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're so right. There's so much hype around the term, and the number of times I see the word AI thrown around when it's not actually AI, it's quite incredible. I'll just start off actually by saying my background actually is not, I'm not a computer scientist or engineer. I think my background has always been in surgical education, in trying to understand decision-making in the OR, where the gaps in performance happen. And so then I kind of met like really smart people who did a lot in computer vision and machine learning. And that's kind of how I got involved with it. But anyways, it's a great field. But AI, just to go back to your question, so okay, AI is really it's a big term. It's really the study of computer science that focuses on machines being able to perform human-like functions, or functions that are traditionally done by humans, like perceptual functions or decision-making, cognitive functions, and sometimes even surpassing human abilities, like superhuman. That's kind of like the AI, the overall study of all this. Machine learning is a little bit, it's a subset of AI. It's the part about AI that has made it so popular, if you will. If you think about traditional programs, if I want to program something, you know, I'm going to write a program, a code, I have to explicitly program it in detail. I have to say, for this situation, this is what's going to happen. For that, this is the situation. And you have to program it for all the different scenarios. Machine learning takes a different approach. It's saying, okay, here's a lot of data. I'm going to find patterns in this data to make sense and to be able to make predictions on new data that I have never seen before. That's the kind of essence of machine learning. So they're very different. Machine learning is a sub form of AI. It's a form of algorithms that are able to perform AI functions, essentially.
I think from reading some of your work, and we'll post links to this, if you're watching this on the YouTube channel, it'll be in the description. If you're listening to this on the podcast audio version, we'll put in the show notes some links to your papers. But my sense is that you kind of don't like either of these terms, or you prefer to use the term surgical data science. Tell us why that term is maybe perhaps a bit better, and perhaps also what is meant by the term surgical data science.
Excellent. And that's a great point, because I think, you know, regardless of what you do, regardless of what branch of research, you really have to be specific in the terms that you use. I try to stay away from using AI as much as possible when you write manuscripts or you give a talk, because, you know, it's a very big, you know, sort of overall overarching term. You need to specify exactly what you mean. Like, for instance, you know, if it's a deep neural network, I'm going to describe it as that, you know, as opposed to saying the AI, I'm going to specify the algorithm, the specific type of algorithm they use for that specific research question, for instance. And I think it's important to do that, especially if we're going to describe our research and it has to be reproducible and so on and so forth. Surgical data science is an important term. And I like that term, because that to me makes more sense from a surgical standpoint, because it's bigger than AI. It's got the application of why we want to use AI into the term. It's much bigger than just AI. It's the overall field of how we use data to improve what we do in the OR. Basically, surgical data science is basically how we capture this vast amount of data from the OR or around our patients. How do we organize it? How do we curate it? How do we analyze it and create prediction models with it, so that we can help us take care of our surgical patients and ultimately improve everything from quality, safety, stewardship, and so on. When I say data, I mean everything from the vital signs, the blood work, the pixels on the monitor during MIS, or, you know, fluoroscopy, all the information the nurses type in the computer, you know, about the ASA score or whatever. This is all data. And when you think about today's practice, you know, we have a wealth of data, and, you know, on patients, and it's up to us to kind of integrate all this data and to kind of use our gestalt on, like, you know, and make decisions around the patient. You know, that's how we decide in UR, you know what, things don't look right. Why don't we divert the patient? I say that because I think you're a colorectal surgeon. So that's kind of how we use data science in our everyday life. But fast forward to the future, we want to be able to tap into those modern computational techniques like AI and be able to integrate this kind of these avalanche of data to find patterns that we cannot see as humans and augment our abilities. You know, we're looking at surgical data science. We're looking at the seamless integration of these kinds of support tools in the OR that'll kind of make us sort of superhuman, improve our situational awareness and things of that nature. And it's, you know, this kind of data-driven augmentation is everything, you know, the decision-making support during surgery. It could be how to tailor the care to a specific patient, you know, perioperative decision-making, things like that. And I mean, if you can picture yourself in the future, you can see, like, again, going back to the example of whether to divert or not, You know, you can have an AI algorithm that says, you know what, based on the pixels I see, based on the lab work, based on all this data, I can make a prediction with 85% probability there's going to be a leak if you anastomose this, and then, you know, help you with the decision support. So that's how surgical data science to me is a little bit different from AI. AI is the actual computational techniques that you use. Surgical data science is a study of using all that for the intended applications.
I'm getting a little bit of a PTSD talking about whether to divert this patient or not, because it feels like 90% of my life is deciding this question.
For me, it's whether or not the parathyroid's there or the recurrent laryngeal nerve.
Okay, so, you know, like, it's funny because, again, you talk about in this paper that you wrote, you're among these many of these great certain scientists on this paper that I think came out of a workshop, talking about the fact that there actually are not that many success stories when it comes to surgical data science, right? Like, you know, for all the hype, where do we actually see, this type of prediction, you know, risk prediction or, you know, decision support? We don't really see it. Like, it's interesting that you talk about specifically about whether to leak or not. You know, there's been all these papers that have looked at the fact that the decision to divert patients probably is more related to the surgeon's personality type, right? Like, are you a risk averse type surgeon or are you not? And less to do with the patient in front of you in the clinical situation, right? And, you know, like, that's just one example. And we don't even use very often very simple, basic decision support type tools. So I guess what I'm asking is, why do you think there haven't been that many success stories in terms of surgical data science? And what do you think it's going to take to actually start to really bring some of this work to fruition?
Thanks for mentioning that, Amir. I mean, that's one of the things that I spend a lot of my time and energy explaining to people, because you're right, there's so much hype out there and there are billions of dollars being poured into this industry. The amount of dollars invested by VC companies into like the hype of like AI in surgery and this and that is so profound, disproportionate. I think a lot of people recognize how powerful this technology can be, but to this day, I have yet to see, I mean, you tell me, have you ever seen AI in the operating room? Despite all the hype, I mean, it's very hard to see. The only area that I've seen it, maybe show a bit of a success, is in adenoma detection rates for colonoscopy. And you may be familiar with some of the new platforms that are out there where you have, you know, you do your colonoscopy and then you have a computer vision algorithm that basically detects polyps and kind of highlights it with a square so that you can, you know, to tell you there's a polyp, for instance. And even that, even despite all the studies they've done to that, whether or not it improves patient outcomes is still up in the air. Like, it may improve your adenoma detection rate, but perhaps these are, you know, things that would never have led to colon cancer or whatnot. So, you know, the AI, we have yet to show the value proposition. And so that's why we need success stories to actually show that it actually can improve things in the OR. And we're not there yet. The stuff that we've done has been a lot of proof of concepts. Like, we know we can use AI to do certain things. Like, I know I can develop a computer vision algorithm to, you know, to tell me whether or not a critical view of safety has been achieved or not. You know, but implementing that into the real world, is it going to improve patient outcomes? I don't know. I'll give you an example. One of the things that we're working on is creating. So all these proof of concepts, they're just a piece of software right now. It's like, it's just a software. Taking that into the operating room, it's a big step. Like, nobody's really done implementation or developed sort of like a seamless tool that people can take into the OR. You can't expect people to buy expensive hardware into every operating room around the world. So one of our work has been in trying to design systems that people can take, like, for instance, their phone or their tablet, and just put it on the monitor and get like the AI to kind of like give you a an assessment, for instance. Things like that are what's going to help disseminate this kind of technology, making it seamless, making it easy, making it scalable. But even then, we have to be able to show that there is value behind it. And so far, I don't think we've done a good job of that. It's hard to show that you know, an algorithm that tells you where to go or where not to go during lab coli is going to improve bile duct injury rates. You know, doing a randomized trial on that is quite challenging.
Oh, it's so interesting. I'm glad you took us there. Let's see if we can go a little bit deeper on lab coli in particular, given that it's one of those procedures that's really the glue across general surgery and a lot of our listeners. You guys wrote a recent paper that was super interesting. Can you talk about go, no go and how, you know, you framed it beautifully, but how that really works in terms of its mechanics and where you see that your vision at the end of the day, maybe ending up?
Sure. That was, so I think just to take a step back, and I think this is where it's really important. I think we can't get, just like any innovation, and I emphasize this to everyone who wants to do this kind of research, don't get sucked into the hype of the technology. You know, first understand what the unmet clinical need is, and then design the solution around that. And that's how we design Go No Go Net. It's, so a lot of my background is understanding how, you know, injuries, how decision making and lapses in judgment and things like that. And one of the main cognitive behaviors that we know that lead to bile duct injuries is this, you know, lack of awareness perhaps, or errors in judgment, where you dissect in a, you know, in a territory where there's a high risk of bile duct injuries below sort of this line of safety, you know, Ruvier's sulcus and things like that. So we trained an AI algorithm. We wanted to keep it very practical, something very practical that helps you during surgery. So we said, okay, it would be great to have an algorithm that kind of tells you these, this is the fly zone, this is the no fly zone, very simple binary, go, no go. You want to keep your dissection, do whatever you want, but just keep it up there above this line, imaginary line of safety. That's important because, and that was a big step because for the first time, we're not just developing an algorithm that can tell you, hey, I see a cystic duct. Well, great. You know, how is that helping me in the OR? If I've dissected the cystic duct, I don't really need an AI to tell me that. For the first time, we're training something to do something very clinically relevant. The second thing is that there aren't very clear boundaries around a go and a no-go zone. It's a very conceptual thing that takes a lot of experience, a lot of pattern recognition, gestalt, of understanding what a safe zone is. So that was one of the challenges in machine learning that hadn't been done before. So that was kind of like the reason behind it. And I emphasize that because people don't really recognize that addressing an unmet clinical need is a very big part of designing an AI solution. So we decided to train an algorithm. We said, can it replicate the mind of an expert surgeon to decide where these go and no-go zones are? So the way we did this was we basically, you know, we used something called supervised machine learning, which is basically you say, okay, AI, I'm going to teach you how to visualize this part of the anatomy. I'm going to give you hundreds of thousands of different examples. So in this example, this is where the go zone is. This is where the no goes in. In this example, this is where it is. And this is where it is. And you give it so many examples that it can learn from. And eventually, after hundreds of different cases and different scenes from those cases, you know, it's able to figure out that this pattern of pixels, this is where the go zone typically tends to be. And this is where the no go zone is. And so that's kind of how we train the AI algorithm. And where we're able to find out is after enough training, it's more or less able to kind of figure out where these go zones and no go zone is. So it's kind of like your mental model as a surgeon being reflected on the surgical field. So you got this kind of augmented reality thing where it highlights these safe zones and unsafe zones during surgery. That's kind of the idea and the motivation behind that.
That's so cool. Not to be negative about it, but where are some of the flaws and some of the places where this approach and this technology falls down, and how do you address that? How do you recognize that, and how do you kind of engineer around that?
No, I did not negative at all. I think you have to be like you got to be negative and critical about your research. Otherwise, how do we develop good, robust, you know, things from this? There's lots of deficiencies and we got to be honest because it's not ready for, you know, real time, you know, prime time use yet. So there's a lot of problems we've noticed with the algorithm that the go, no go net algorithm. There's a lot of also problems in general with AI and deep learning. So I'll just start with the algorithm itself. One thing that we noticed, which was really interesting, is as I was analyzing videos, I came across a problem. And this is such a great illustration of one of the deficiencies of deep neural networks. Deep neural networks are designed to basically, like I said, take big, complex data sets and find patterns and then make predictions. And sometimes it takes the easiest path to find those predictions. So one of the problems we found with this was the AI, we found that every time you had an instrument in the surgical field, it was biasing the results. And so it tended to move the go zone around where those instruments was. So a big question became, wait a second, is it telling you where the go zone is based on the underlying anatomy or based on where the instruments happen to be? You know, it just happens that most lab colis, the instruments happens, you know, the dissection tends to happen in a safe zone, as opposed to an unsafe zone. So is it just learning the wrong thing? And so we had to kind of accommodate, you know, make adjustments to the model based on that. That was one bias we noticed. Another one we noticed, and this is one of the areas where Go No Go Net doesn't fully succeed, is whenever you don't have good exposure of the anatomy, it's not able to tell you properly, like, this is the safe area or this is unsafe area. When the gallbladder hasn't been retracted properly, it doesn't, just like us humans, like, I can't properly assess where it's safe, where it's unsafe when I don't have good exposure. And this goes back to training an algorithm for a very specific function. Ultimately, it's not going to be one silver bullet AI algorithm that's going to solve bile duct injuries. It's going to be a library of algorithms that can replicate many cognitive behaviors, like good retraction, safe zone dissection, critical view of safety, like all the different things and nuances that make you a safe surgeon. So that's one of the other deficiencies we noticed. And then the other one was just like, again, like a surgeon, whenever it was so zoomed in that it just sees like fat and fibrous tissue, it had this sort of tunnel vision where it had no idea where it was. And it's like, sure, go there. And it was like, no, not in a safe place. So the algorithm doesn't work well when it's kind of very zoomed in. It has to, you know, see its anatomical, you know, just establish its bearings a little bit. And newer models that we're using are actually integrating memory into it. So it's not looking at individual frames in and of itself. It's looking at, you know, based on frames I've seen previously, okay, this is not actually a go zone, even though I'm zoomed in. So deep learning has a lot of deficiencies, a lot of biases, and you just have to be really, really careful on how you use this technology, because it can introduce biases that you never thought of before. And going to the, you know, AI in general, not just its biases, but there's a lot of problems with it. Like, for instance, you know, people want to know. So if something tells you this is what I recommend, you want to know why. Like, why do you think I shouldn't divert the patient? Well, because of this reason and that reason, you know, to help us and to guide our decisions. This explainability is one of the big lacks in AI. It's kind of like this black box where it's really, really good at making predictions, but it's not really good at telling you how it arrived at those decisions. And so there's an entire field of explainable AI that's trying to target that, so that, you know, so if I'm a surgeon and I'm using this kind of algorithm, you know, I can have some explainability around it, and there's going to be more trust, you know, around this kind of technology for people who want to adopt it in their OR. And so that's definitely one of the big problems. Another problem is generalizability. So if just because I train an AI algorithm from data from my institution does not mean it's going to work as well at your institution or even across the street. I'll give an example. You know, let's say you train an AI algorithm to tell you where to go or where not to go during a, I don't know, colorectal operation, and you trained it on, you laugh, but that's actually one of our next projects. But anyways, you train it up to do that, and you basically train it on only on, you know, University of Calgary data, and you've used only one platform like Storz or Olympus or whatever, you know, the video itself is very different from another platform. So it's guaranteed actually that it's not going to perform as well in someone else using a different platform, for instance, or using a different resolution, different aspect ratio, or somebody likes to have, like, you know, the full view with the black circle around, like, you know, the circle. Somebody likes it zoomed in so that the full, like, all these nuances are very important. So you want to train an AI algorithm, it's important to have a very wide breadth of data, real world data that you're going to see. You want data from many institutions, from different healthcare systems, from different platforms, you know, people from different anatomies, different demographics, people that use different instruments, different techniques, and so on. Because that generalizability is a very big key part of it.
I mean, like you mentioned, your background is in surgical education. And I remember you actually came to Calgary promoting the Fuse platform when I was a resident. That's all about surgical energy and stuff. And so, you know, I wonder in your surgical education brain or with that lens on, where do you see this fitting in from an education perspective? Because, you know, in some, like the explainability piece, I think is a big in some way, I don't know if you can say it's a problem, but it is a challenge in that, you know, a lot of the things that you're talking about in terms of what the AI has trouble with, like those are human challenges that we have to learn as trainees. Like I'm reminded of Dr. Ball and I, you know, one of our mentors, Francis Sutherland, you know, he talks about this bile duct illusion, right? And so when you ever you do a lap Coley with him, he makes you like have it zoomed out. Like he doesn't allow you to actually move the camera in closer when you're doing a lap Coley because of this issue. And so I just wonder, like, do you think, I guess my question is, how do you see this? Where do you see this being implemented in actual surgical practice? Is this something like you switch on at the end of a case to sort of, before you put the clips on, to give you an additional data point? Is this something you have on all the time? Where does that interact with training? Like where does it behoove us to like actually train ourselves to recognize these problems and these issues? And how does that interact with these types of algorithms and platforms?
That's a great question, Amir. I don't know if we have all the answers to that. I think we're just kind of seeing this starting to be introduced into the OR, and we've started doing surveys and qualitative studies and needs assessments surveys and things like that for end users to kind of figure out how they want this technology integrated. I think that there's kind of two main themes that that you can kind of see this. And when I say AI, I think I just want to emphasize, we're talking about a lot of the work that we're doing, computer vision. AI, like you said, can be used so many. You can make prediction models on whatever data sets you want. It can be for perioperative decision, intraoperative navigation, and things like that. Our areas has been really focused about in the operating room, an algorithm that kind of gives you navigation and guidance. So for that specifically, I think that there's sort of two areas, two themes that we've noticed. One is intraoperative deployment, and one is postoperative on the videos that have already been recorded. I can see this being used in a number of different ways for educational purposes, for quality improvement, for feedback, for assessment, for coaching, and it ultimately depends on the end users and what their use case is. Like a lot of people are not very keen to use this in the OR, we've noticed, especially since this is a very new technology. You know, there's not a lot of validity evidence behind it and things like that. But they're very happy to take their recorded videos, sitting on their computer and seeing what the AI told them to do, told them they would have suggested, and analyzed their performance, and then use that as sort of like an educational experience. Or you can use it for residents as well. Perhaps they can get a safety score of some sort. You can use this for video-based assessment of residents. And we're actually doing a randomized trial right now using this for residents to see whether or not it actually improves their performance. Do they become safer? Does it change their practice and things like that? So I think there's a huge opportunity for post-operative integration. The second piece is intraoperative, and that's been more challenging, obviously, because you have to integrate a technology in the OR. It's got to work with the OR workflow and the equipment and the nurses, and that's a bit more challenging, and we're not there yet. Like the way we've kind of done the initial deployment was we design a pipeline where I can take the laparoscopic tower, plug it into my tablet that I'm talking to you with right now, and basically have the video feed from the tower on my tablet and get the AI on a monitor. But who's going to have a you know, who wants to have another computer in the room, having them with guide them? Like, that's just not really well integrated into your workflow. So the question begs, so how would you use this in the OR? So I think that if for some people, it may be the situation where they, you know, they don't want to invest extra hardware to have this integrated into their OR. And they just want a quick like assessment to say, hey, am I on the right path? Yes or no. Okay, I don't need it anymore. Let me continue the surgery. So you can use it that way. Like the example that I gave where you can take your like your iPhone or whatever, take the camera on it, put it on the monitor, and then just get the AI to give you an assessment. That's one of the ways we see this technology as being scaled every operating room around the world. Another way is there's going to be a need for some people who, especially when algorithms become a lot more powerful, to have a sort of plug and play solution where you, you know, you literally plug the AI into the monitor or into your integrated OR, and it gives you on demand, high performance AI inference in the OR, and you can turn it on and off whenever you want. Now that begs the question, people who are doing unsafe maneuvers, they're oftentimes unaware that they are doing unsafe maneuvers, and they may not have the awareness to turn on an AI, you know, algorithm to guide them either. So a lot of questions remain. I don't know, you know, I don't think I have all the answers, but I think in my opinion, we're going to see AI sort of integrated as sort of like a fly on the wall, kind of watching you. You know, if it sees something that you're about to do something, maybe give you like an alarm of like, hey, you know, just maybe rethink what you're doing. Try this instead, or, you know, maybe you should bail or change your approach.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think how things might look in the future. We have to, since you mentioned it, what do you think ChatGPT is going to do to surgery? Like, is this just a gimmick?
I don't know.
Or do you, or no comment?
No, it's, look, ChatGPT is a big game changer, but we don't really know where. It's so powerful that we don't really know where its applications will lie. But it also has a lot of problems too. Like, it's really good at like generating, like, you know, like we were joking around with it. I'm like, with ChatGPT, I'm like, write me a song in the style of Taylor Swift about surgical AI. And it like wrote me a song, like, and a really funny song. Like, it was really good. Like, things like that is really good at. It's actually changed a lot of things, like for programming. Like, you know, one of the engineers I work with was made a joke. It took him 2 years to train something that, you know, one of our proof of concept for 3D modeling and computer vision, and took him 2 years to write a code for that. When ChatGPT came, it took him literally 10 days to do the same thing. So there's actually a joke amongst computer scientists that the new programming language is English, because you just need to type, this is what I want, and like it'll give you the computer code for it, so you don't have to do it from scratch. You know, you can see ChatGPT used for patient care. Like, you know, patients have questions about their surgery. You know, they have like a quick thing that they need to answer, you know, instead of trying to call the hospital to figure out their answers, they got ChatGPT to help them. You can see a lot of potential there. There's a lot of problems too. Like, as you know, ChatGPT will also give you references that it'll make things up that don't exist, which is a big problem. So it's a very powerful thing. I just don't exactly know where it's going to come into play, to be honest, in terms of clinical applications.
It's all very exciting, all kind of nebulous, all kind of interesting. So it is an exciting time to be alive. What's that?
The field is moving way too fast, faster than we can keep up. You know, not just in terms of knowing what to do with this, but also how to regulate it as well. So
yeah, that's a whole discussion for another day about sort of the ethics around this and what is, you know, how do we roll this out in a way that's safe and all that kind of stuff. Because I think that is an important consideration, you know, particularly around ChatGPT. But you wonder about the tools that you're developing, how they're going to be implemented. You know, does that have, what kind of legal, you know, ramifications does it have? Like, if your go no go said don't go there and you went there, like, right, like you could see some interesting scenarios coming up down the road. And I don't think we know the answers to any of these things yet.
Absolutely. I don't think we have precedent for that. And ultimately, I think it's going to be just like any technology that uses in the OR. ultimately you have to use all of that in with you know, a grain of salt and at your own discretion, because you know, ultimately these prediction algorithms have their confidence intervals and things like that. And that's part of what we've integrated into our newer platforms, is information about how confident it is about its predictions for you.
Dr. Madani, thank you so much again for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure. One of the questions that we ask our guests at the end of the show is, if you could go back in time and give yourself advice as a chief resident, or perhaps even as an early attending, although you're still probably still a young buck, but you know, if you could go back in time and give yourself advice, maybe as a chief resident, what advice would that be?
Oh, it's, I don't even know. Like, that's a tough question to answer. I think it's it can be anything, not necessarily related to surgical AI. I think the number one thing I would tell myself is trust your training. I think, you know, when you go out into practice, I think there's a lot of unknowns, and you're not sure of yourself. You question yourself, you question your abilities and things like that. I think one of the things I would go back and tell is, it's okay. Like, you got this, you've got the skill set, and you'll be fine. Especially in Canada, we get really good training all around. And the other thing is to not be afraid to ask for second opinions, ask for help, or just, hey, I just want to run this case. This is what I'm doing. You know, I know it's probably right, but just want to run it by someone, and kind of helping that build your confidence so that you can finally fly from the nest, or whatever that analogy is. That would be kind of, I guess the one advice I would say.
You've been listening to Cold Steel, the official podcast of the Canadian Journal of Surgery. This episode was produced and edited by Kirsten Allen, one of our new team members on the Cold Steel team and a medical student at Queen's University. If you have comments or questions, please email us at podcast.cjs@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.